Usually it's hard to know where a legend gets started, like Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. Sometimes all you know is somewhere, at some point in time, it just took off and people started talking about it. Well, that's actually not true of the legend of the whales in Great Salt Lake. Lynn McNeil, a folklore scholar at Utah State University, says that one we can pinpoint.
In 1888, an article is published in Montreal, Canada, talking about an absolutely amazing development happening out west in the state of Utah. This article gets republished in the Salt Lake Herald for a local audience, telling the story that took place 13 years earlier. And the story that this article tells is of Mr. James Wickham. He's described as a scientific English gentleman who has the brilliant idea to bring whales to the Great Salt Lake and begin what would surely become the great whaling and whale oil industry of the state of Utah. Now, this article gives a lot of detail about how this happened. It describes Wickham traveling to Australia. He needed to find a breeding pair of whales. Obviously, we need an ongoing, replenishable population. He captures his whales. He brings them by ship all the way to San Francisco, where, as odd as it sounds, they board a train. Huge tanks of water constructed to contain these whales. Additional tanks constructed to hold the extra water that they will need for their journey across the West and into the Great Salt Lake. As the article reports, this project is a success. The whales make it from the train into the water. Wickham had built a pen to enclose them, to keep them, so that he could be in control of their movements, of their actions. And of course, as nature so often unpredictably does, the whales don't care about that fence. They push right through it. Wickham's last view is of his whales disappearing into the depths and the distance of the Great Salt Lake. And this, of course, kicks off what begin to be whale sightings. People later coming back and reporting that they've seen not just those two original whales, but their successful offspring spouting and kicking up their tails across the surface of the Great Salt Lake. This story has so many different layers of meaning. It speaks to industry and creativity and invention in the late 1800s. Ideas of environmental possibility. And it speaks most loudly, I think, to the incredible uniqueness of the Great Salt Lake as an ecological and environmental resource for us as Utahns. This story is implausible. It's impossible. Whales cannot survive in the Great Salt Lake, and yet the detail that the story gives us and the obvious interest it held for populations from Montreal to the Western United States tells us that we like this idea and we still like this idea. We still have sightings of whales in the Great Salt Lake. We still have people asking that question. Wait, is this real? Did this happen? It speaks to us of this idea of hopefulness. That the lake isn't disappearing, that the lake isn't a lost cause, that not only is the lake going to be okay, but it could sustain this massive and magnificent life. And if we can care about that, then we will make sure that that is the future.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the legend of the whales in the Great Salt Lake today, which is the subject of a short film called Whales of the High Desert, which, starting now, you can go and watch for a limited time. We'll give you more details here in a moment. The film is about the legend and why it might matter to people at a time when the lake has been struggling to survive. We have with us the folklorist Lynn McNeil and the film's director, Joseph LeBaron.
I think that we didn't really have any kind of idea what the story really was in detail. You said, I've got a folklorist that wants to talk about whales in the Great Salt Lake. It's this long-standing story from a newspaper article.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to do the interview?
Yeah.
I thought it might be like a nice 3-minute story and leave it at that.
So you started cutting the story. I remember I started cutting the basic story after the conversation with Lynn McNeil. And at first, I think, if I understand the way you are processing it, it's interesting. It's a kind of a goofy kind of hoax or something. What is it about? But then it just sort of sits there. And I don't know. Explain to me. Over time, you start to see something else in it.
Yeah, so you created the first cut with the audio, and I wasn't excited about the project until I heard your first cut.
Huh.
And then I listened to it, and I was like, this is actually a really pretty story. And I think the reason that it stood out is because in Utah, I'm Utah native, you get so many pioneer stories.
Yeah.
But like these are the stories they started to tell once they were here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking, well, what are all the legends that people bring from their own country to this place, and how is that influencing maybe what this story is?
Yeah.
So you created the first cut, and I thought, this is beautiful. And then I started thinking about incorporating someone reading this article as if it was someone waking up June 8th, 1888, and reading this for the first time. And then you throw a little music behind it, and then it's a problem because then you get an idea.
Yeah.
Also, to choose to do a period piece in the winter on a lake that's dying.
Yeah.
Having the team around me that I did, it was huge.
I was going to come to this later, but let's just say right now, you, because of the condition of the lake, you couldn't shoot out there.
Yeah, we tried. We did try like every year from like probably 2018, we'd go out there. And we'd go out there in the spring because that's presumably when it gets the deepest with all the runoff. And we're like, man, is it just a bad year? And then you start to see, well, we've had a bad decade, bad couple decades.
Yeah. Okay. Lynn McNeil.
Yes.
There is this article that appears in a Salt Lake newspaper, a major newspaper in a city in the United States, 1888. There's this really baffling question about like what was the purpose of that? Was it trying to fool people? Was it just a bit of whimsy? Was it a writer having a go? Was there some sort of literary twist in here? Like what was that about? Do you think you understand that?
It's really hard to say.
Yeah.
What's happening here. And it's because we're missing a lot of the context of daily life at that time in 1888. It's important, I think, to note that the article ran earlier in a Canadian newspaper.
Yeah.
So when it first ran, it was talking about Utah from very far away from Utah. And then Utah picks up the story itself. And we get different perspectives. Some historians think the Utah paper published it to say, look what these crazy folks who live so far away think is happening out west. Or others think that the Utah publication of it was, hey, this puts us on the map. This is exciting. This is cool. We want this to be about us. We want this to be true. And One thing that always stands out to me about this newspaper article is that it's published in 1888, but the event it's talking about is in 1875, and that's a 13-year difference. So that's like news being published today that happened in 2010, which isn't the distant past by any means, but maybe far enough out that we could be convinced that, oh, hey, I don't quite remember that happening, but yeah, okay. Okay, that sounds plausible. You know, it's a good distance in time for a legend to thrive.
You say in the film that legends and myths thrive on ambiguity. Is that what you're getting at there? And what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so legends as a genre, folklorists define legends as stories that are told as though they are literally true, despite having miraculous or outrageous elements that might make it hard to believe. And that doesn't mean that the people telling them always believe them. It means that the impact of the story is derived from the possibility that it's true. And because of that, we see stories like that thriving in contexts and social situations of ambiguity where we have questions, we don't have a lot of answers, so we invoke this genre of possibility, one of the ways that we symbolically talk about what could or couldn't be true in the parameters of reality. That's when we use legends.
So you don't just think that, because honestly, this did occur to me. How is this not just a hoax that some suckers bought in 1888?
It sure could be.
Yeah.
And we actually see that happening still today. We have the intentional publication of satire all the time. And the minute you remove the context that says this is for sure satire, you remove the text of an article from the headline of The Onion, and suddenly we have something that, depending on your perspective on the state of the world today, just might be true. The best satire toes that line really well. And so we've always had this push and pull between hoax or satire and truth or reality.
Joseph, did you ever wonder, oh, come on, am I being a sucker here by just giving into this at all?
So, I mean, I know what I think about it.
Yeah.
I think that the thing that appealed most to me is that some person did just post. And 150 years later, we're continuing on the story. And, like, that's wild. It's fun.
So you do think it was a goof?
Oh, yeah. No, well, this is what I think. I think that that someone knew, or maybe not. I don't know. I don't want to give anyone too much credit. But the process that goes in people's heads every time they hear about this legend is, no way. Well, it's salty. I don't know. Mm. And then, like you could have, like, an inner debate in your own head. And so – so maybe someone was trying to mess with people. I don't know, but for sure the motivation is, I think, satire.
But it's interesting. Like, satire, it could have been just somebody having a go. But in some ways, it does have the basic – doesn't it, Dr. McNeil? Doesn't it have the basic characteristics of a good legend or a good tall tale in the sense that it does sound like – it's supposed to be an actual story.
Absolutely.
I mean, they went to enough detail to create an English gentleman who has an idea for this incredible enterprise.
Yes, absolutely. Folklorists have talked about the hallmarks of a good urban legend being, among other things, authenticating details, specific names, specific dates, specific places. There's too much here that is so specific for it to seem like a story someone's telling. When we think of an urban legend or a contemporary legend in the abstract, we think of someone saying, you know, you'll never believe what happened to my next door neighbor's best friend's hairdresser. Yeah. And we're like, yeah, nobody believes that. But no, it's not like that. They come to us about specific people. We might not know their names, as we know James Wickham. Mm-hmm. We know he's British. We know the year that this happened, and we have all these details. But legends are actually fairly specific, and that makes them seem very real. And they don't err in the opposite direction either. We don't have too much information. We don't know who built the tanks that James Wickham used. We don't have his passenger manifest that shows his name on ships between, you know, different countries as he seeks out his breeding pair of whales. If we had too much information, it would seem too perfect. Legends really, really need that perfect balance of very specific detail and then open-endedness.
One thing that I really love about that, too, is they took full advantage of not knowing about whales at all in the 1880s, because they're talking about whale eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And so people are like, yeah, sure, whale eggs.
Yeah, whale eggs. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
But I think what's interesting is, so it has the basic construct, it seems, I guess, of a legend. But the way these are supposed to work, as you said, that open-ended part I think is interesting to me, because as the story goes along, you're supposed to come to a kind of punchline. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this one really has enough of a punchline to make it clear to people that, no, this was a goof.
I think that's absolutely right. And that's one of the distinguishing characteristics between a tall tale or a narrative joke and an urban legend, is there's that twist, that punchline that says, oh, this was false all along. I sure had you sucked in. I sure led you on well. And now you know it's fake because of this truly outrageous or ridiculous thing that I've said. And if you think of classic tall tales, we can see that happen often. But in this, it hangs there. It's, and the whales escaped and are living their own lives. Someone spotted them. They'd reproduced. Dot, dot, dot. And that's it. And that leaves us to fill in with our own expectations, our own experiences, our own idea of what's possible and not possible.
It's Lynn McNeil. She teaches folklore at Utah State University, along with Joseph LeBaron. He directed the film Whales of the High Desert. Joseph LeBaron, you've said that one of the things that you wanted with this film was you wanted to make it, this is how you put it, beautiful. What do you mean? Why? Why was that important?
So, again, I'm a Utah native, and yeah, the Great Salt Lake was just something you drove by.
Yeah.
And you could smell it. And if you did stop at the shore, it was usually like the one most easily accessible to the freeway or something.
Yeah.
So I didn't ever think of it as a destination place. As soon as we went all in, we started location scouting, and that place is beautiful. It's gorgeous. We've circumnavigated the lake I don't even know how many times. And you've got places out there that look like Iceland, just wild rock formations, and the water gets crazy colors. And I mean, geologically, it's beautiful, but then you have so much life out there too, and I had no idea. I had no idea that there was that much life out there. So when we decided to tell the story, we really did fall in love with the lake, and I guess we wanted other people to feel inspired to go check it out themselves. And if we can make it beautiful, maybe they'll go.
So part of you wanting to make it beautiful was also to be able to convey something about what was happening to the lake, the fact that it was dying. I mean, it wasn't just I guess if I understand it, it stopped being just about this legend and interesting hoax or whatever it is. And in some ways, the current conditions of the mm-hmm. lake started to influencing mm-hmm. the way you thought about the film.
Yeah. When we go out there and we're like, all right, where are we going to launch a boat?
Yeah.
And we can walk out into the lake for a mile and a half.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, we can't. And you can start to see that this story we're trying to tell about a legend, the lake that supposedly contains this legend could become legend itself someday. And so, yeah, it did. I think it turned us into activists. And that was a story element that I was surprised fit so naturally into the story that you had set up 9 years earlier.
You know, it's interesting. I don't want to sort of give this part away, although we'll come back to one of these, this theme. But it is interesting how the idea of belief and or wanting something and the idea of life comes to fold into the film. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. When we were doing the interview with Dr. McNeil, I'm sure you remember this because I didn't really even have an ending the week leading into the interview when decided to do a new interview with her. I reached out to you while I was driving out to haul a couch out to the middle of the lake to interview her. And you said, but what's the story about? Is it about whales? Is it? And you were kind of left it open-ended, and it pretty much triggered, I'd say, 5 extra questions in the interview. And those 5 extra questions changed the entire direction of where the story was going.
Dr. McNeil, there is something that you mentioned in the film that I wanted to ask you about. Mm-hmm. You said that the setting for a story like this in the late 1800s in the West, this is how you put it. You said it was a wild west of ideas.
This isn't just the Wild West as we know it, full of outlaws and cowboys. This is a Wild West of ideas. Why whales? Why here?
The enormous value of the new industry can be better appreciated by remembering that a single whale produces 20 tons of pure oil.
What I think this really illustrates for us, it doesn't just tell us about it, it gives us an example, is this whole era of possibility that we could start a whaling industry in the desert of the Intermountain West. I mean, how could there be a more far-fetched idea than that? And yet, here it is being spelled out for us. And putting this in the context of this time of hopefulness and prosperity and ingenuity and creativity, I think speaks to a time that we would love to get back to. I think when we think of the environment now, we hear more despair than hope often. And visiting or revisiting this time through this story of someone who had this idea that seems totally harebrained, but maybe just might work, and so many people coming together to make it happen, and the train trip. I love that visual image of these, you know, behemoths crossing the West on a train, as humans have for so long, taking this trip that people themselves have taken into this new and unfamiliar and so often inhospitable land to find a home in the Great Salt Lake. I think the idea behind the story, the abstraction of ideas, speaks to this really idealized time in our minds.
Let's talk about James Wickham, scientific English gentleman, as the article puts out. Joseph LeBaron, what does Wickham want? How are you understanding him as a character?
Oh, yeah. This is one of my favorite things to explore, because the key was how he was described as a scientific English gentleman.
Yeah.
The scientific part. The article follows right back up and says something like, he's maybe been forgotten by everyone else except for naturalists and capitalists. So those are the other two categories of people that would remember this guy.
As considerable time was required for the development of the experiment, the subject has passed out of the public mind, but has by no means been forgotten by naturalists or capitalists interested in the whale fishery.
So capitalists, why? Because of the whale oil. Naturalist, because that's wild. You're going to take whales from Australia and what? So then you put him as that third character, and he's a scientific English gentleman. I think that he wanted to prove he could do it. That's it. I don't think he was after money. I think he needed money to do it, but he wanted to prove he could.
Because he could be just a craven capitalist. So that was the other question. Like, is he a good guy? A bad guy, a gullible guy, a dreamer, a schemer. You think he's a dreamer?
I think he's a dreamer, a reckless dreamer, in the sense of like anyone born from robber barons or like the Tammany Hall, era, just like doing crazy stuff because we've got this new industrial revolution that will allow it to happen.
You know, and I have to say, this is really one of the most kind of delightful parts of the film is the particulars of getting 2 whales from Australia to San Francisco to the Great Salt Lake, And Joseph, I wanted you to talk about, I mean, we see rigging, we see ropes, we see a wire fence, we see just, I mean, you had a rigging built basically.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about your own fascination with the idea of how would they actually make this work?
Yeah, well, we avoided that at first. We're like, no, we're just going to just say the whales got here.
Yeah.
And then that just felt like a cop out. And so we started.
Why? Because that's interesting, right?
That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's like, well, whales got here.
Yeah.
That when people say, well, no, they did or they didn't. But if they did, how could they possibly? The people that say they did, how?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the kind of mind that we inhabited. It was like, well, there. First off, it had to be a successful pair of breeding whales.
Yeah.
And so you're talking about – and then they said they spent 2 years finding the particular pair. And then they had to build special rail cars for them with 50 other tanks of water. Again, they have no idea how whales work.
You know? Right.
Like they have no idea. So when we started thinking, well, then once they get here, how do you unload them? You don't like – open the back of a train cart and dump them in. Like you're going to have to rig them and then you have to hire locals. So what was really a nice occurrence for us was our actor who plays James Wickham is a guy named Andrew Call. He's an excellent artist and a carpenter. Mm-hmm. So our Wickham actually built the rigging.
Is that right?
And he did all the illustrations for how this could happen in this journal the whole time. So it was fun.
The Enterprise, Dr. McNeil, is one of the core parts of the story, I guess, for you, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the parts that gives us that really good, chewy discussion that the best legends lead to, where you sit around with your friends and debate, no, wait, could that actually happen? Because the reality is we can transport whales. They get to SeaWorld somehow. You know, we know this happens. It doesn't necessarily happen by train in the late 1800s, but so we start to really negotiate possibility with the technology available then, even with the technology available now. Could we have done this? How could this be? And so really thinking it through and spelling it out and taking the time to make it a focus of the narrative is leaning in, I think, to that especially appealing part of the story.
Joseph, would you just talk a little bit about the scene you directed where we come to that moment, this peak moment in the story where the whales are in this pen in Great Salt Lake and they break free.
And in an instant, shot through the wire fence as if it had been made of threads. In 20 minutes, they were gone, lost to their new home. And the astonished Mr. Wickham stood gazing hopelessly at the big salt water.
To take on such an endeavor, you have to be probably a pretty cool-headed person as far as like, just, I'm doing this nutty thing and I'm going to let it play out. And the stakes are so high and we're talking boats, trains, all kinds of wild things, all the wild things that happen for these whales to arrive. He drops them in the water and they're there. So he was successful. Like that's the thing is he was. Like in this story, he's successful.
But it worked.
It worked. So imagine going from it being successful to they're gone and you can't do a thing about it.
Because
the one thing you didn't work out in your plan is how are you going to control these Leviathan, you know?
So Dr. McNeil, you say that Wickham at this point now, he disappears.
One of the things that makes legends this really useful barometer of what a population is interested in, anxious about, intrigued by, whatever, is that they don't last if they're not relevant. And if they become irrelevant, but it's still a good story, we'll adjust it or adapt it to make it last so that we can still have it. And I think at this point, Wickham drops out because we don't need him anymore. That's no longer what we're talking about. Now we're talking about the whales. We're talking about the lake itself. He was our catalyst to initiate, to launch this story that now has an entire life of its own that's based in what amounts to people's sightings of things that look like it might be a large sea creature. Joseph referenced a leviathan, an enormous creature living in the sea. We know that this is an inland lake, but it's saltwater. It has that unique factor that changes the game. Maybe this one's different. And then we add to that just this truly almost alien landscape where your eyes can play tricks on you so easily and where we do see things we don't expect. We do encounter, as Joseph said, more life than we would have ever expected to see. And suddenly that doesn't seem so implausible anymore.
There's this question that Dr. McNeil raises in the film, Joseph. Why would the story of whales living in the Great Salt Lake, why would that matter to us today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it becomes pretty clear at that point that this story can only exist if the Great Salt Lake exists. And it's important that we have a lake that can sustain a legend.
So, Dr. McNeil, why it matters is because it presumes a lake that is still alive, I guess.
Yes, I think that a lake that could even possibly, yeah, without any guarantees, but possibly support whales is a lake that isn't gone, isn't over. I think we see this with a lot of different legends about the environment, creatures that may or may not live in the environment, like Bigfoot. I think we see in there a real desperate hope that we have not ruined our chances to discover wondrous new species in our natural environment. And I think on the human side of that too, Utah has a long history of people thriving in unexpected and unwelcome environments in really surprising and unique ways. I think that's a big part of Utah's identity, and that might be pioneers of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints coming here and, you know, to this inhospitable desert and irrigating and planting and growing and finding a home. That might be people coming much, much later to what's seen as a largely insular religious community and finding welcome and acceptance in their own place in the natural environment. We have a lot of different layers of people finding a really unique and sometimes unexpected fit in Utah. And what better metaphor for that than a whale in the high desert? And I think we see that there's the whale statue on 9th and 9th that, you know, Salt Lake Arts described as a symbol of resilience. And that, I think, is really telling. And the following that whale has, the whale sculpture went up and we got winter back. We got snow. We got rainfall. The lake levels rose for the first time. There's a following for this whale. And it, again, like so many things in Utah, it becomes this really unexpected symbol of what makes us unique.
Okay, final question. And I don't want to overdo this, but what could a legend, a film like this do for the lake and how people think of the lake? Because one thing Bonnie Baxter told us in our conversation is that you want people to see the lake as unique and mysterious and being capable of life. So do you feel like stories like this, even in some way your film, will make a difference?
Yeah, that when we had the idea with you to really go all in, it was just going to be a film. When you spurred me to look a little bit deeper into what this film was really about, we decided to reach out to an impact partner, Friends of Great Salt Lake, and they're on the front lines of raising awareness for this cause. And, you know, their most important goal is to get people to go see the lake, you know, see it for what it is, care about it. want to see what they can do to help support the cause. It's a forgettable feature for so many Utahns, and if we don't bring to the forefront, if we don't care, then it'll just slowly die, and no one will care to change any legislation or do any conservation efforts to keep it around. So the film does have a purpose now. It's to help people fall in love with the lake. The wells are secondary.
It's Joseph LeBaron. He's the creative director and co-founder of The Good Line. He directed the film Whales of the High Desert. We also had with us Lynn McNeil. She's an associate professor of folklore at Utah State University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.